and my master came up. I did my PhD at Cornell University in applied physics and working with very small materials and looking at their interactions with cells. And then here at McMaster, I am in the Department of Chemistry. I'm an analytical chemist, but still working a lot on materials. Materials at very small scales and their applications to biology, understanding how cells respond to microenvironments, as well as the development of new sensing platforms, for example, to detect pathogens or other materials that could be useful to replace fossil fuel derived materials with more environmentally sustainable materials. So at McMaster, I've been now 9 years. I'm an associate professor, currently Canada Research Chair in Micro Nanostructured Materials, and teaching first year chemistry, which I really like.
That's very exciting. And that all sounds really interesting, including the topics you mentioned, which we'll get into the interview in materials and applications to biology, as well as some chemistry in there as well. So just to begin, would you mind explaining the focus of your research? I know that you have your own research group as well. Kind of the focus you take to our audience for listeners who may not be aware.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'll start with saying that we work with materials at very small scales. So if you take the width of a hair, we're typically talking about 100-fold to 1,000-fold to 10,000-fold smaller than that. Wow. So they're very, very small materials. And we work with these small materials because they're interesting in a couple of ways. They show different properties than the materials you experience on everyday, handling and management. But they also are at a scale that's close to the scale that's relevant for cells. And so when you start getting at the scale where now cells see these materials not as, you know, very large objects, but as small objects that they can wrap themselves around, that they can pull on, that they can interact on, now you can start understanding a lot more of how cells behave in our body, where they encounter all these microenvironments that are really what dictates how they work. And so in my group, what we work on is designing materials that we can, where we can mimic those microenvironments in the body to try to understand how topography plays a role in cell behavior and phenotype. Also how we might be able to develop new sensing platforms, for example, if we want to detect a pathogen. And so all these small size materials become important for a number of applications. So in my group, we work with traditional fabrication techniques where we make these small scale materials through photolithography and techniques that were inherited by the semiconductor industry or from the semiconductor industry, as well as new ways of making structured materials. And so one of the things that we have is we've developed this approach where we shrink a substrate. And by shrinking a substrate, we can induce structuring in materials. Okay. And so we've used that to, again, develop sensing platforms and for microenvironment studies with cells.
That's very fascinating. And especially that topic of microenvironments that cells interact with, really interesting stuff. And a lot of people may be interested in that subject, but not know much about it. So I find that was a really amazing thing to read, especially we'll get into more of the substrate level research that you guys have done. I had a question about that as well, actually. So I know that your group has had success in being able to develop a method through which you can structure thin films at the micro to nanoscale level, as you've said, through compressive stress induced by shrinking a substrate. Could you explain the process of what it was like to be able to achieve this goal? Maybe, you know, some of the hurdles that you came across constantly, or really any struggles or issue you ran into and how you dealt with them and persevered through?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is a process that you mentioned that arose sort of as a side project where, we saw these toy, right, called Shrinkadings, which is really a sheet of plastic that you can bake in the oven and it shrinks, right? And so what we thought was if we put materials on top of them and we have a specific pattern, whether, you know, it's a maple leaf or it's anything that you want to imagine as a pattern, and then we shrink it, then that pattern will shrink, right? And so that was the first iteration. We came up with that idea of maybe shrinking patterns and not having to use fancy techniques like photolithography to make structured materials. But then what happens when you put something that's rigid on a substrate that's shrinking is what would happen if you take a piece of aluminum foil and you compress it, right? So it wrinkles, it crumples, and it gets all these structure on its surface. And the same thing happens when we put a thin film on a surface that will shrink. The thin film is rigid enough that it will buckle, wrinkle, and then crumple. Oh. And so by doing this process of shrinking, you can get really fine structures. And so the other thing we found is that if you play with the thickness of that film, you can change the size of the wrinkle that you get. And so you can go from nanometer scale to micrometer scale. And so I think that process we came up with really as a side project, but then it became interesting enough that a lot of our projects now are following up on that and the different applications that these structured materials might have. And I think the biggest challenge to projects like this is really to get the students to realize that this is something that maybe happened by chance,
yeah, right? Yeah.
And that mm-hmm. they will have many instances in their graduate career and their undergraduate career where things that happen by chance or you weren't expecting are sometimes the more exciting results, right? And where new things can come up for them. So I think that that's something that in my group, at least, we try to encourage creativity and taking alternative approaches to traditional problems. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes, we work with biology and that is challenging in its own right because biological systems are incredibly complex. Mm-hmm. And so, trying to marry the materials that we make with some important relevant systems is where we're looking for new ideas.
Yeah, definitely. And it's kind of incredible to be able to hear stories like that how you were able to achieve these certain results due to hard work. But I feel like it's beautiful to look at how it was created too. So in your case, you mentioned it stemmed from just a passion of just observing a toy that's shrinking and seeing what it was able to do. But how it led to, not only did it spark creativity amongst the members of your research group and encourage them to, focus on this and be able to achieve something greater yeah. out of just a simple observation. And I think that's kind of amazing to see, especially, being an undergrad, seeing how we're able to take so many avenues to learn within university. Mm-hmm. Being able to find that passion or that topic that we're passionate about and really, be able to relate it to our everyday life in order to figure out something new that we didn't know before yeah. or continue to build on something. Yeah. So that leads me into my next question. So as someone who's been involved in the areas of biomaterials and devices, imaging, sensing and detection, interdisciplinary, nano and micro, smart materials and devices, all of these various topics, being able to manage all of these passions alongside teaching, mm-hmm. truly incredible. How are you able to stay up to date with all of these things in your life on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really great question. It's very hard to stay up to date. There are lots of new developments coming out every day. The number of journals that exist is multiplying, right, very rapidly. And so it's really, really hard to keep track of everything that's happening, right? And even though I receive the daily alerts from the journals that I follow and that are in my field, mm-hmm. I more and more rely on my students. And my students are the ones that keep an ear to the ground to, bring up to my attention mm-hmm. new projects or new publications that might be of interest that maybe relate to something that we're doing or complement or build on something that we're doing. Mm-hmm. And I think that having, a good network of people that you can have productive discussions, scientific discussions, like graduate students, undergraduate students, as well as colleagues, it's incredibly important to stay up to date. And I think that nowadays with, Twitter, Facebook, and all these platforms, it makes it a bit easier to see, what people are working on even before things are printed. And so that has also helped, and it helps stay up to date.
For sure. It's interesting that you mentioned, if for especially social media. So on one hand, as you mentioned, thousands of journals are probably being published, within a month, dozens every day. That are all, relevant topics. But it's very interesting to see how you're able to use social media the one thing that's already presenting you with a problem. Hey, so many journals, but you use it to network with people who can keep up to date with those journals. And the connection you have with your students is also really amazing, and how they're hardworking and being able to achieve such successful results under your research group. So just a question that I had was, when you originally entered the field of chemistry, and in particular nanotechnology, what was it that interested you most about this field?
Yeah, so I came to the field of chemistry sort of in a roundabout way, because my undergraduate education was in engineering physics with a minor in biotechnology, and then I did a master's in biotechnology, and then I decided to go back to applied physics for my PhD. And so I was mostly on the applied sciences, engineering, bio interface. During my postdoc, I did a switch, and I went to a lab that was doing development of biofuels from plant materials. And so there I was exposed to a lot of analytical techniques. And so really, when I came to chemistry, it was really through the analytical technique side and the interdisciplinary background that I had built. And in particular, nanotechnology attracted me when I was in high school, because I started reading some popular science magazines where they were talking about nanotechnology being the next big thing. And then one of the papers that caught my attention was a paper by Harold Krahit, who was a pioneer, or is a pioneer of nanobiotechnology, where they were making these pillar structures on the micron scale, and they were using these pillars to guide the growth of neurons, and then to try to regenerate neural connections in severed spines. And so that really inspired me, because I thought, you know, if you can control how cells move and how cells communicate, it's a very powerful tool.
For sure.
And so when I did my PhD, I approached this professor, and he welcomed me to visit Cornell, and that's how I ended up doing my PhD with him. So I talked to some of his graduate students that were working on these projects, and I thought, you know, this is something that's really interesting. This is something that I would like to explore.
That's incredible.
And obviously, we haven't solved the problems, right?
Yeah.
We're still trying to understand how cells interact with micro and nanostructured materials. But that's where it all started for me.
That's incredible. And yeah, it's amazing to see how it's been able to push you to, you know, be able to form your own group now and give that same opportunity and give back in a way to students as well, which is really nice. So my final question is, what do you believe the next steps are for your research group? You've already achieved a lot of success in your studies. In your opinion, when it comes to continuing your goal of utilizing surface chemistry, micro and nano fabrication to create these functional materials, what is the next steps? And are there any other current projects that you're excited about or maybe looking forward to?
Yeah, I think that, well, over the last couple of years, we've been switching our research focus a little bit towards more sustainable materials. And so now we're looking at nanomaterials that are derived from nature. So taking plant materials and making these nanofibers and nanocrystals that we can then use to design different materials, and materials that can be used to replace some of the fossil fuel derived materials. So those are some of the areas where I'm most interested in, because we've also developed some chemistry that we can use to modify the surface of these nanomaterials to make them functional or compatible with other things that they're not usually compatible in. And one project that I'm particularly excited about is using these renewable materials, bio-based materials, to create 3D printing inks. And so 3D printing inks that can, you know, be used to make different kinds of surfaces. They can be used for tissue engineering. They could be used for environmental remediation. And so I think that the nexus of nanotechnology and renewable materials and sustainability is going to be a very exciting area in the future.
For sure. And it's something that's also very relevant with all the issues we're facing. So certainly that'll be very interesting and amazing to see as it goes on. That concludes this week's segment for Scientist of the Week. Thank you very much for joining us today, Professor, on SciSection, and it has been a pleasure having you.
Hello, and welcome to SciSection. My name is Jereen Anthony Pillay, and I'm a journalist for SciSection Radio Show. We're here today with Dr. Frank Prado, the founder of the Lawson Imaging Research Program. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for interviewing me.
So to begin, could you talk about the Lawson Imaging Research Program you founded? How did it commence, and what were some of the challenges you have seen at the very start?
Yes, I've been working at St. Joseph's Hospital, which later became St. Joseph's Health Center, since August 1976. And I was hired as a medical physicist to help grow the nuclear medicine program at that hospital. Some visionaries at the hospital who decided that maybe we should have a wing of the hospital dedicated to medical research. And that started to be put together in 1980, 1981. And in 1982, I was the only medical physicist in the hospital, but I proposed that a new technique called nuclear magnetic resonance imaging had a future for patients, and that it would be an excellent platform to initiate a program within the Lawson Research Institute, which would become eventually Lawson Imaging Research Program. So that's how we started. We got interested in something that would later be called magnetic resonance imaging. It was a very early technology, and we were fortunate enough to get sufficient funds from various sources, including the director of the Nuclear Medicine Department at St. Joseph's Hospital, and also some funds controlled by the Sisters of St. Joseph's, who at that time ran the administration of the hospital. So with those funds, we purchased and we got running what is now called a magnetic resonance imaging system. It was very primitive compared to the systems today. It was running with very low magnetic field strength of 0.15 Tesla. And right now, the MRI imaging is done at 1.5 Tesla. So let's see, 0.15 at 1.5. So it's about 10 times higher, or 3 Tesla, which is 20 times higher in field strength. But the images even then were very promising. So we started a research program, and we started what would become the imaging program, among other programs, at the Lawson Research Institute. And so that was back in December 1982. We produced the first image of a patient who had a small stroke, and we could actually detect it. And I remember working with the nuclear medicine specialist, the MD, and we went down to coffee and looking at these images. He said, "This is fantastic, Frank. We can see this very small lesion in the brain, and we've not been able to see that in any other way. This is really exciting." And I was concerned that maybe there was a glitch somehow in the machine and it wasn't running properly. It was 3 more years before we started getting some funding from the Ministry of Health in Ontario to pay for scans to be done in patients for diagnostic purposes. So we had 3 years of 100% research on the machine, and then we progressed. And around that machine, we built the Lawson Imaging Research Program.
Mm-hmm. And like you said, your team produced the first human MRI in Canada, as well as the first human hybrid PET and MRI in Canada. So how did people react to these new imaging technologies at the time?
Well, I was a young man at the time, 30 years old, and I was really pleased to get the first image. But, the group at Princess Margaret Hospital, under the directorship of Mark Henkelman and Mike Bronskill, they got their first image on a same piece of equipment about a week later. And when I was a young person, I was fairly competitive. And so I can remember pushing the construction to get things going. And we just made it by 1 week. Also, the group at University of British Columbia got delivery of a unit, but they had a little trouble getting it to work. So I think we beat them by a month or 2 months or something like that. So clearly, there were about 3 sites in Canada that were coming online at about the same time. So with MRI, we continue to progress. And as you know, MRI is extensively used now clinically, and research keeps going. Research keeps progressing, and it's an amazing technology with amazing opportunity. It's very flexible in terms of how it makes an image. And people are imagining always new ways and inventing new ways of making imaging. So MRI is very exciting. But MRI is limited in sensitivity, can do marvelous things, and it doesn't expose anybody to ionizing radiation like X-ray does. But it has limitations. If there's a change in your body, say a change in a cell that becomes diseased, that change has to be something like one change in 10,000 compared to the surrounding cells. So you say, well, that's a small effect, and that's a small thing that can be detected with MRI. That's great. But I became interested in positron emission tomography as the technology, which has the downside of exposing individuals to ionizing radiation like X-rays, but they're called gamma rays. But the advantage of positron emission tomography, instead of seeing one part in 10,000 change, it is very sensitive. It can detect one part in a trillion. So many orders of magnitude more sensitive. But it's much more flexible because it's much more sensitive. If you want to, in MRI, if you want to detect changes by injecting a contrast agent, which changes the MRI parameters so you see where that contrast agent goes, you have to inject grams of material. If instead you want to see a contrast agent that is injected for positron emission tomography, you only have to inject nanograms of material. And because you have to, you can inject such small quantities in positron emission tomography. Positron emission tomography is very flexible, and you can make new contrast agents that you know eventually will be approved for human use. Whereas new contrast agents in MRI are difficult to approve for human use because you have to inject so much, and people are concerned about perhaps some unwanted effect caused by injecting so much material. So, but MRI doesn't use X-rays. MRI produces exquisite images of high resolution, images of the body, you know, sub-millimeter. You can see about 60,000 cells in an individual image element. Whereas with positron emission tomography, it's the images are more blurry, but extremely sensitive. So the idea was to combine MRI and PET, where MRI would produce the high resolution images, and PET would produce the great sensitivity to detect disease very early on. So putting those two together was very exciting for me. So we worked very hard to raise the money to do that, and we got a very large grant from the, and it was a citywide proposal I led, and we got a very large grant from the Canada Foundation for Innovation, and we got basically about $35 million to introduce new technologies. Now, with positron emission tomography, unlike with MRI, if you have a contrast agent, you buy the contrast agent, it stays on the shelf for a year or 2 years, it doesn't matter, then you can inject it into a patient, and there is one approved contrast agent, basically, in MRI. With positron emission tomography, we inject radioactive material, and that material is designed so that we reduce the radiation dose to the patient. It's designed to disappear very quickly. It disappears so quickly that you have to make it locally. If we want to make it locally, we have to make radioactive material using a particle accelerator. So this large grant, large part of it was to build or to buy a particle accelerator that we would install in the basement of St. Joseph's Hospital. So that's what we did, and we started the project about 12 years ago. It took a long time to get everything going. We had to get approval from Health Canada, approval from the regulatory agencies in Canada that control the use of radioactive material. We had to hire a team, and then we started doing some experiments that no one else can do almost in the world. For example, because we have the PET-MR system right next to this particle accelerator, we can produce things which have a half-life, that is half of it disappears in 2 minutes. So, and you can use something for about five or six half-lives. So you make it, you have to test it that it's safe to be injected into the patients, into humans. And then you have to use it within 10 minutes. And you have to collect, you have to inject it into the patient within 3 or 4 minutes. And then you have to collect the images. and everything's sort of done 12 minutes after the material is made. So this is not an easy thing to do. You have to have the chemists, you have to have the people who know how to run the particle accelerator, you have to have testing to make sure that the thing, whatever you're going to inject, is safe, and then you have to transport it to the PET MRI, you have to inject it, and you have to be doing the imaging very quickly. So that's the technology that I've introduced. So I was happy, pleased, fortunate to be able to introduce MRI into, say, London, Ontario and Canada. And then with PET MRI, we were fortunate to introduce that into Canada. We were the first in Canada, and we remained the first for about 3 or 4 years. Now there are instruments in other parts of Canada. And it was about the fifth unit in the world at that point in time. So, and the unit has remained largely research. And so we're doing research work that many other people can't do. So for example, there is a PET MRI in this Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles, but they come up to our site here in London, Ontario, to do research because I have been able to coordinate with the help of many a unique infrastructure that allows us to do experiments that really can't be done in very few of any places in the world. So that's given us some excitement of things to do. I'm not doing all that work. Well, I've over the years, or I've been at St. Joe's 44 years. Over that period of time, I've been able to recruit some outstanding people, and I've been able to recruit people with different skills, different disciplines. You know, we have an engineer running our cyclotron facility, for example. We have people with appointments in physics, appointments in medical biophysics, appointments in cardiology, appointments in biomedical engineering. So I've been able to put a group together, and I can show you some examples at some point in time how it's important. Because the excitement for me right now as an old guy is we can do many sophisticated things because we have the talent and the mix of talent and the interdisciplinary talent. We can do things that I couldn't imagine doing on my own when I first started out. Mm-hmm. I'm going off a bit on a tangent. Old men tend to do that, and I apologize.
No, it's perfect. It's really fascinating, so thank you for that. So what do you think you did differently compared to others that helped you become who you are today?
Oh my gosh, that's a difficult question. A lot of people I know have been more successful than I have. And so I don't know really how successful I have been. I think to be successful, one has to have a passion and dedicate time to a particular goal. And that means making some sacrifices. It doesn't mean that you can't have a family life, but it may mean that, you don't do some other things that when you were younger you might want it to do. You know, maybe spend a lot of time watching sports on TV or things like that. So I think it was the opportunity to work at an institution that is not a large institution. St. Joseph's Hospital is a teaching hospital, but it's not one of the smaller ones. But to be able to work with people that have supported me and supported my vision. And I also believe that one of the advantages is I've not jumped around in my career. I've stayed at one place, and I've been able to establish relationships, and I've been able to establish what I would consider is integrity, so that people understand my motives. And my motives, as I said, is to do good research that I'm excited about. I find it fascinating. I always like to know that I've got something that no one else in the world knows. That's an exciting thing. But I think that's it. And one other thing that is occurring to me that is important for that. Oh, I guess we'll get to the question of advice to students or advice to anybody. You know, it's occurred to me that if you do not own your failures, You cannot own your successes. So if you blame others for your failures,